Hello, and welcome to Silo Busting. I'm your host, Glenn Gruber, an innovation strategist at EPAM Continuum. Today's topic is evergreen and ever-increasing in importance to smartphone users, which is pretty much all of us, app security. In this episode, Sam Raymond, EPAM's Chief Information and Security Officer and Senior Vice President, chats with Andrew Whaley, Senior Technical Director at Promon, a pioneer in app security software whose solutions are serving companies all over the world. In particular, Sam and Andrew are going to focus on mobile app and edge device security. As mobile and IoT devices proliferate and more apps are running on the edge, the threat surface area for many companies is increasing exponentially. And while companies like Apple and Google are doing yeoman's work to provide safe and secure platforms and distribution, there are still many ways that bad actors can and do inject malicious code into your app or device. But don't freak out. There are a lot of new tools and techniques that can be used to protect the apps that you build and deploy for your customers, employees, and partners. Sam and Andrew will talk about what's different today in the tool chains used to build and deploy apps, the latest in the use of runtime and integrity controls, and how to use layered code obfuscation to dissuade hackers and other ne'er-do-wells by amping up the effort required from minutes or hours to weeks or months. They'll even touch on what's next for nonlinear and quantum computing. We may be past Halloween, but if you're an IT security pro, scary season never ends. Take a listen and enjoy, if you dare.
Andrew, it's been a while. good to talk to you again. Yeah. So, and talk about something we used to work together on quite a bit too. So it's fascinating, but I'm honestly completely out of touch about this, and you're the expert in the area. So I'm going to have fun asking you what the latest and the greatest in the area is, but maybe just for the audience, just to start from a mobile, very edge type of application, if you will. Mm-hmm. What is the attack? What is the concern? Because I hear this a lot from people who says, yeah, mobile, but I store my data in the back end, so what? Or, yeah. You know, I expose just my API, so what? So could you help maybe the audience understand what exactly is the threat? What is the concern from that perspective?
Sure, absolutely. We've probably both been long enough to witness the sort of transformation from sort of web sort of centric servicing to mobile apps. So before I got involved in this space and the way I got into it is I work for a bank, and obviously banks are keen to sort of lower the cost of processing and to push more and more self-service towards customers. So a key part of that was basically using the facilities of mobile apps. So, you know, you think you've got the camera on there that you can use for QR scanning. You can use that for check imaging. So you can deposit checks into your account just using your mobile phone. Based on that, they can do lots of other things, providing their security around that. So one example was integration with call center. So because you authenticate into the app as a user, you can then basically click the speak to us button, which will route you through to the call center. By encoding a one-time code in DTMF tones, you can completely bypass the ID and verification questions that you normally get when you go to a call center. So having this mobile app and having a large degree of trust around it opens up lots of lots of opportunities for interesting use cases. But the key point there is you have to be able to trust that. You have to be able to trust the security model that you've got around it.
Yeah, that's a very good point. And I find it amazing how one of the key aspects about mobile applications is how available it is. I told people like if people were paying me to actually get into and try to find vulnerabilities on systems, there are tricks that everybody does. And one of them was actually trying to get an interview with the company so you can get to the Ethernet port, because you can't get to the port back then. You know, you can't even get on the network. So you have to get to the conference room so you can plug in the Ethernet port and so on. But these days, mobile application, everybody could get to. That's the other aspect of it, which is it's out in the open, right? Yeah, so anybody can see that binary code. Anybody could touch it. Anybody could, reverse it and so on.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean that's the kind of key difference, isn't it? I mean, it's going back to, I mean, you're probably old enough like me to remember the days of client server computing, where you would have good logic on the client side, and obviously the data tier will be on the server side. But in those days, those clients were typically deployed in a secure enterprise. The difference with mobile apps is it's a client server model again, but of course all the client code is distributed outside of your enterprise to end users, and some of the end users would be criminals as well, and that they have access to that code, they can reverse engineer it, and come up with ways to attack that. So often we hear that, but it's a secure platform, and Apple and Google, they do a pretty good job of keeping their platform secure. They patch vulnerabilities pretty quickly and push them out there. And that, they have lots of good foundations in place, like secure bootloaders, code signing, sandboxing. If you think back to the Windows platform, Windows never had any of that. It just relied on the fact that you had physical security around the device.
ActiveX has an interface called I Support Security Interface that all you got to do is return true, and then you're secure. So it's true. I don't know if you remember, but that's true.
We see the same sorts of things. I mean, for instance, on the in-app payments model for Apple, when that first came out, there was quite a simple API that said, has this component been purchased? And you could stub that API and always return yes and get access to free bits of functionality if there was no server-side fulfillment of that. Even though those platforms are relatively secure compared with how desktop used to be, I know Windows has caught up a lot and has many of those things now. But there's still ways to attack them. The apps can be attacked before they reach the device. So you've got something called a repackaging attack, where basically somebody takes an app out of the app store, makes modifications to it, and then republishes it. This is particularly prevalent on Android, and just relies on the fact that people make mistakes and pick the wrong app when they install it. You've got things like supply chain attacks. We've seen a few of those, particularly targeting Xcode, where basically Xcode is modified to inject malicious software into an iOS app before it's distributed. And we're seeing more and more kind of open source, which is attacked in things like Maven repositories, which then get brought into apps. So, there's a lot of ways of attacking the app before it even gets on the device. And then there are then secondary attacks that can be done once it's on device. So for instance, if you're on a rooted or a jailbroken device, then you've deliberately disabled like the first line of defense, which is a sandbox. You've also got root exploits, which are regularly used. So some famous ones were the iMessage exploit on iOS, which was used by the Pegasus spyware. So that basically meant you could send a specially crafted iMessage, which when it's received on the device basically gets root access, and you can even delete the message so the user doesn't even see it, and meanwhile you've got remote code execution on there. There was a similar one called Stage Fright on Android, which was a GIF file which had been encoded to carry a payload, which then got remote code execution. And then there's a whole host of other attacks, things like overlays, where one app can sit in front of another and make the UI look different and trick the user into tapping the wrong thing. This is something called tapjacking. And then there was an attack called Strandhog, which was to do with activities. Because typically the way these mobile apps work is there's activities stacked on top of each other, and you could manipulate that and inject a malicious activity into a legitimate app, or have it return into a malicious activity. So there's many ways. Even though Apple and Google do try and keep the platform secure, there's many ways of attacking apps. Both before they get onto the device and when they're on the device.
Gotcha. Maybe a couple of those, if you don't mind, maybe dig into a little bit. I'm being selfish now because I remember, what was that interface? What was that toolkit called? Was it iHappy or iSupportHappy? That was the one that basically injected. That was a supply chain one. that was injected a library into a whole bunch of Xcode. 200 apps would affect it.
Yeah.
On those incidents, because we're obviously supply chain is a big concern. I didn't think of that's a really good point, by the way. I didn't think of mobile as part of it. It's absolutely true, is that the tool chain is actually infected. And then from then onwards, you don't even know. But whatever code that includes your code or the binaries that's generated would be affected. And usually they would do silent mode. They would actually, you know, the data exfil for a long time. And then, like, for that one, I think it was data exfil for, what was it, 18 months or 19 months that nobody found out about it. Everybody thought it was a clickstream application or some kind of ads library, but turns out they were doing a whole bunch of data exfil.
Yeah,
that's a tough problem to solve.
It is. And I mean, you know, you think about modern software development, you know, probably most apps are made up of 80% open source software. You know, how many of those app developers actually go and build that source themselves from source and actually read over it before they compile it? You know, probably close to zero, I would think. So you can see how this is going to become an increasing problem that that sort of polluted open source libraries are making their way into to legitimate apps.
And for people who's interested about how they managed to, so this is not that the poisoned Xcode compiler was actually shared on cache sites. So for people who could not download from Apple or for people that is from countries that it's difficult to download, they were providing a service that pretend like they were caching Xcode so you could download it faster. And obviously the cache version is modified. And so it doesn't, it's not that obvious. In a lot of these cases, it's not one technique, but it's, as you said, Andrew, multiple techniques cascading on top of each other. So it's a tough problem. This is a problem now, obviously, with IoT, needless to say. So it's not just mobile. Anytime that the source could be touched, could easily be accessed by. So now we're talking about a lot of edge processing as well and so on. Think of all the devices out there and so on. Car, automotive, we talked about a lot. In fact, you know, we're talking to a lot of vendors about automotive as well, where the car is, as you heard Tesla said, is a software company, which I believe so. It truly is a software company. The amount of software is tremendous in that car, but also the concern about, you know, security is also higher. The need for protection is high. So maybe switch gear a little bit and help us understand. So what could be done? It's a tough problem.
It is a tough problem. So, I mean, for the supply chain attacks, there's quite a few companies now that do software called software bill of materials. So an example of that might be someone like Black Duck, for instance, or Grammatech. So what they do is they scan either the source code that you're building or the built binary, and then try and produce a catalog of everything that's in it. And you know, the advantages of that are you can identify licenses, for instance, so you can make sure you've not inadvertently included any GPL, which would you know, oblige you to distribute your source code, which obviously most commercial companies don't want to do. But also, if there are any known vulnerabilities against particular versions of libraries that you might be using, that could be highlighted. And then if there's any unidentified material in there, you know, maybe you've been subject to a poisoned supply chain, you know, that's the time to investigate it. So that's a way of kind of preventing those supply chain attacks, which kind of attack the app before you publish it. And then there's the controls around, you know, how do you protect the app once you've published it? So, you know, thinking back to that banking example I had, where you're doing ID&V process, and then you're using that then to launch other channels like telephony channel or handoff to the web, for instance. If it was compromised in the mobile app, then, you know, it's not just giving you access to one channel; it's potentially giving you multiple ways of attacking the bank. So, you know, that's when you need things like runtime controls. So that might be measures against debugging, might be anti-hooking, it might be doing things like root checking. So it's basically looking for kind of active attacks on the device. And one of the things to kind of remember is it's not necessarily a remote attack. It's not necessarily some malware that somebody's put on your device that's attacking that. It could actually be the end user themselves. You know, they could be trying to bypass certain controls. So I guess, you know, software piracy is an obvious one. People trying to bypass license controls, trying to bypass in-app purchases, for instance, or in games cheating. So having these runtime controls is a good line of defense against that. Related to that, you've got integrity controls. So when you distribute the app, you know, you know what it should look like. So you can bake in a network of checksums. You can redo the signature verification that you know, both Apple and the Google platforms do. So if that's been subverted on a particular device, you can detect that and then decide what you want to do about it. And then, you know, probably the most important one is code obfuscation. So obfuscation is quite valuable because it's kind of necessary to protect those runtime controls so they can't easily be found and removed. But also if the app itself has got any kind of sensitive IP. So, you know, think of the banking app you're doing, IDMV, that's bound to involve a cryptographic process. And, you know, it's probably better that malicious third parties don't understand how that cryptographic process works, because if they did, they might be able to find ways of kind of working around it or subverting it in some way. So code obfuscation is kind of a foundation, really, that the other controls are built on top of.
It's really interesting, by the way. I've had numerous arguments with folks about, and usually for people who've actually never done an outside-in assessment on a binary code, trying to reverse it or try to extract the key or whatever, they won't understand this. But to your point, it's not about one technique. It's not about two. It's about the level of effort that the attacker would have to go through versus the yield.
Correct.
Every little bit helps. Every little bit helps. Everything that you make it easy for them, the amount of time spent is less than they would continue. I remember I had problem with a simple a stack frame that I was trying to work around. And I don't know what the technique was that they were using, but they were moving it around and it frustrated the heck out of me until I just, like, you know, I don't even have the brain power to continue anymore. And that was effective.
Yeah.
Because anybody that read a lot of assembly code could tell you that, you know, it's fun in the first 10 minutes and then it started to deteriorate from then onwards. So I think it's very interesting that, you know, it's a problem that requires quite a bit of layering, if you will. And I'm not just talking about typical control layering, but I'm talking about, you know, quite a bit of layering of these techniques so that the yield is not worth it for them.
Yeah, exactly. You know, if you think about it, there's not that many people out there that are skilled in reverse engineering. You know, most of them kind of work in the sort of pen test industry. You know, they're well paid. They don't have time to waste on this sort of thing. So if you layer those protections on top of each other, you know, something that might take, you know, an hour to reverse, you know, typically sort of unprotected Android or iOS app, you know, using the right tools, disassembler like IdaPro, for instance, you know, you could probably find what you're looking for within, you know, minutes in some case, or certainly an hour or two. Once you layer obfuscation on, you then have this impenetrable forest to go looking for. And, you know, a sufficiently motivated person with a lot of time on their hands would eventually get there. But, you know, that's basically the price that or the cost that comes with an obfuscated sort of protected application. It means that the immediately accessible ways of attacking it are taken off the table. Somebody then has to really, really want to put in that effort to do that. And then you're probably talking, you know, days, weeks, months to achieve the target rather than, you know, minutes or hours.
Yeah. Every one of those topics, Andrew, honestly, I could talk to you for hours over it. And maybe we should. I can have you back and we could talk more in depth about each one of those. But I have a bit of a wild card. I want to hear what you think about it. So this is a bit of a curveball. You can tell me you want to talk about it in the next podcast and spend a full half an hour talk about this, or you can give me a simple answer. What are your thoughts on post-quantum? Not just quantum computing, but just the fact of nonlinear programming. What's your thought on it for security? Any thought at all? Or?
I mean, you know, the obvious danger is you know, certain crypto algorithms are not quantum secure. So things like RSA and elliptic curve. So I know there's been a lot of effort to find alternatives to that. You know, things like the lattice-based encryption that is supposedly quantum resistant. But I don't know enough about quantum computing to know how applicable it would be to, you know, some of the software security techniques that we've talked about. But I know, for instance, that, you know, some of the AI capabilities that we've seen recently, like the large language models, could, I think, be successfully used to attack some of those current protections that we've got. Now, I guess, you know, AI running on a quantum computer might be a super capable sort of technology that you could bring to bear on that.
You jump ahead of me. I was exactly leading into that question, which is there are multiple ways to get to nonlinear. An expert system, obviously, is another way to get to nonlinear result. And so that would be, and you don't need zero Kelvin to do that. So, you know, maybe that's the next concern. Maybe that should be our next discussion on our next podcast to talk about that. I saw some of you posting on LinkedIn about that topic as well. Love to hear more about it.
Okay. I can certainly talk about that. I mean, I've certainly done some experiments with things like GPT-4 and, you know, considering it was never trained on reverse engineering, it does a surprisingly good job. So it's, you know, it definitely highlights an emerging capability that AI has in that space. And I think that's something that we all need to be wary of.
I agree. And the tools for the bad guy side is actually the thing that's scary. We're seeing so many scanners. We're seeing so many tools out there from the attacker perspective. Tell me a bit about what you're working on these days, about your company a bit, Andrew, before we go. I know your company's in this space that we're talking about specifically.
Sure. I work for Promon. So it's a small Norwegian company where we were growing very strongly. It was originally came out of the University of Oslo. That was in 2006. And since then, we've grown and we protect apps in finance, gaming, health, government, some military. It's definitely an area that's growing for us. We started off doing sort of desktop Windows applications, back in the days when security on Windows was a problem. You know, things like viruses were a sort of huge ever-present threat. And since then, of course, moved to mobile, which is where probably most of our business is at the moment. And we've been developing new obfuscation techniques, so binary-based obfuscators, primarily for iOS, Android, but also Linux, Windows, Mac OS. So binary-based means that it's actually protecting machine codes, so it's completely post-build. So one of the problems that a lot of customers have had in the past is that obfuscation techniques need to be embedded in the tool chains, and that's always a bit of a maintenance headache. And particularly as we've recently seen, Apple have announced the deprecation of bitcode. Bitcode was a very nice, easy way of doing obfuscation, and now that's been closed off. So binary really is the only approach in town now if you want to cover iOS and potentially Mac OS apps. So that's what we've been focusing on. And then we've been doing lots of research around AI-based attacks and how we would defend against those. And, you know, we should hopefully be releasing some of those things kind of early next year.
Andrew, thank you so much for your time. I think I even have a list of topics I want to invite you to come back and talk about. So maybe when you have time, let's come back and talk some more. But so good to talk to you again.
Yeah, no, I'd love to, Sam. And it's been nice to talk to you again.
This has been Silo Busting, a podcast from EPAM Continuum. EPAM Continuum integrates business, experience, and technology consulting focused on accelerating breakthrough ideas into meaningful impact. Why do we do this? Because real opportunities aren't siloed. Thanks again to Sam Raymond and Andrew Whaley for a thought-provoking conversation. Of course, none of this happens without our amazing production team. So many thanks to Kit Pilalis, our sound engineer extraordinaire, for getting this podcast recorded, and to Ken Gordon, our tireless producer. I'm your host, Glenn Gruber. Thanks for listening.